The Queen detested Buckingham Palace. Yet in December 1886, she had returned to the fogs and fumes of a London she loathed to receive a delegation of 200 peeresses of the realm on business related to her jubilee. Little about Victoria resembled the engaging young girl of 18, whose accession nearly 50 years earlier would be celebrated across the breadth of the empire throughout 1887, and for which the visit of the ladies was preparation. Dressed in black, and in the fashion of 1861, as she had been since the death of the Prince Consort 25 years before, needing a walking stick to support her ample yet tiny frame, she might have been anyone's elderly, well-to-do grandmother. Only Buckingham Palace itself, and the small army of guards in bearskins and courtiers in velvet, suggested the Queen Empress. Some of the peeresses, on their way to the palace, may have seen hoardings that pleaded on behalf of Guy's Hospital. 200 beds closed for lack of funds, special appeal for £100,000. They had come representing a fundraising campaign from the women and girls of the United Kingdom as a mark of their loyal appreciation of Her Majesty's public and private character. The solicitation was to be extended to the colonies, as £75,000 had already been collected in the British Isles alone, in contributions ranging from one penny to £1 sterling. Now Victoria was herself invited to decide upon the form which the accumulated offering shall take. Other British ladies, some of them also peeresses, in a jubilee presentation signed by 1,132,608 women of England, had a more specific purpose, urging the Queen to lessen want, strife and degradation, as well as the temptation to drink on the day of rest, by the Sunday closing of pubs. Such an appeal was hardly likely to enlist Victoria's support, for she preferred whisky to milk in her tea, and had little sympathy for Sabbatarian zeal. Nor was she interested in funding beds for Guy's Hospital. Perhaps she was unaware of the institution's plight, as she seldom ventured into the lower reaches of London and never read a newspaper. In any case, she had long made up her mind about the Jubilee largesse. The funds, she announced to the ladies at her audience, would be used to commission an equestrian statue of the late Prince Consort in Windsor Park. The number of statues of Prince Albert, in every conceivable posture from recumbent to equestrian, was already dismaying to those who perceived more urgent national needs. Much of the kingdom failed to reflect a golden jubilee aura. Unemployment and poverty gripped the richest nation in the world. Unrest in the colonial reaches, upon which the sun never set, belied the beneficence of what was called civilization. Yet the British press reported the Queen's recommendation to the peeresses without suggesting that she had confused her priorities and without urging either abdication or revolution. As much myth as monarch after half a century, she could do little wrong, except in the eyes of the extremists, to whom few paid any attention. Even the once feisty Algernon Swinburne, who earlier had poetically praised regicide and republicanism, and had composed scurrilous, even obscene verses about Victoria, now wrote to praise a blameless queen of an empire that no seas confine. Britain had buzzed with rumours that Victoria would use the occasion to announce her retirement in favour of her eldest son Albert Edward, an ageing playboy to whom she had given little to do. She had privately confided more than once, to people likely to gossip to Bertie, that she hoped to outlive him, that he was unfit to be king. Moreover, his eldest son, Prince Eddie, officially Albert Victor Duke of Clarence, was even less fit to reign. Backward and almost uneducable, allegedly bisexual, cosseted by bands of tutors and equerries he wanted only to elude, he was the best contemporary argument for a monarchy shorn of responsibility. The portly Prince of Wales at least knew how to handle people, his mother accepted, but even there he managed a small triumph. His New Year present to her was a Jubilee inkstand. Commemorative trinkets were already flooding London shops and stalls. The lid was a royal crown. When it was lifted, one saw the Queen's face and its reflection in a pool of ink. "Very pretty and useful," she confided to her diary.